see, Ryan, there are still faint glimmers of civilization left in this barbaric slaughterhouse that was once known as humanity. Indeed, that's what we provide with Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica fair trade beans. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half calf. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this marvelous coffee to you in Canada or the US within 1 week of custom roasting it so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor, not like that cat piss they serve in the dining car. You can order Sparkplug a la carte, or you can join the secret society of the Autopilot Coffee Club. It's customizable and flexible so that you're always getting just what you want, when you want it, without having to think about it. And if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, and that's all one word with a number 100, Sparkplug will give you 20% off your next coffee order. So what are you waiting for? It's time to make your mornings without question, without fail, always and invariably exceedingly lovely. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Does it come in pink? It's a Wes Anderson movie. It should come in pink.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hello, all you twee chaps and chapettes, and thank you for downloading the 390th Ellis's Analysis. What we do is go back some years to review classic films, and we spoil those classic films. We also spoiled all 123 AFI greats on their 1998 and 2007 lists, so go way back in our catalog to find talks about City Lights, Psycho, Saving Private Ryan, and so many more. I'm the guy who has never been a fan of the color pink, but I do love it in Wes Anderson movies, Ryan Ellis. And here's that charming wife who's always right beside me as we travel free and unmolested through Europe, or anywhere, Bev.
That's me.
Not much molestation in our travels so far. Curious to think this is a bit of a war film, top of everything else. Okay, the coming attractions trivia question for our final film in Oscar month, The Grand Budapest Hotel. Have Wes Anderson, P.T. Anderson, so Paul Thomas Anderson, and or Paul W.S. Anderson ever competed for an Oscar?
No. Wes Anderson was only nominated for this film in 2014. P.T. Anderson was nominated twice in 2007 for There Will Be Blood and in, I'm going to get this wrong, 2019 for
Phantom Thread?
It
may have been a few years before that, something like that. I meant in any category ever, but the answer is still no, even if you include writing, producing, or anything else.
Oh, okay. I was just looking at directing. And as for Paul W.S. Anderson,
bit of a joke inclusion.
Yeah, I guess Alien v. Predator didn't get any nominations.
He's better known for the Resident Evil movies, actually.
True. Maybe he'll never win a competitive Oscar, but he'll get like a lifetime achievement.
Ridley Scott's next, then him.
Yeah.
For the directors. You're right, though. They were up for an award, Wes and Paul Thomas, in 2014. Well, 2015, but for the 2014 movies. PTA for adapting Inherent Vice and Wes for original screenplay of this movie. And of course, Wes was also up for directing and producing, which he never had been before, and PTA had been before, so they swapped roles in a way. Okay, after being shown at a slew of festivals in February, the Pink Hotel movie was released by Fox Searchlight. And it's now under Disney's banner, by the way, so if you want to see this movie, it's on Disney Plus. In mid-March 2014, it doubled its budget here at home and made quite a few bucks worldwide. In fact, it's still Wes Anderson's biggest hit. And by the way, we're covering it, even though it didn't win Best Picture, because we didn't really want to cover A Beautiful Mind, English Patient, what's it called again, Around
Grand
the World in 80
Hotel.
Days. No, Grand Hotel could be next year, and probably should be next year. That'll be an anniversary, not this year. But this movie maybe should have won that year, certainly could have, and it won four big ones. We'll get to that in a second. So that's why we're covering this in Oscar month. It did win a bunch of them, just not Best Picture, Best Director, and so on. But Bev, the movie is, what, 7 years old now, so please remind people what it's about with The Grand Budapest Hotel Skinny.
Rafe Fiennes is Gustav H., the vain and devoted concierge of the Grand Budapest Hotel, a posh resort in pre-war Europe. After learning of an inheritance from one of his favorite patrons, Gustav is falsely accused of her murder and must clear his name despite the machinations of her family and the encroaching fascists descending upon their corner of Europe. Throughout his adventures, Gustav develops a close bond with Zero, his lobby boy and protege, who remains devoted to Gustav throughout.
That's my lobby boy. Hands off my lobby boy. Who knew Ralph Fiennes could be this funny? I think any actor probably could be funny, but to think this guy could be this funny.
He's so funny.
And he was overlooked for even getting nominated in 2014. Should have been. Or in a nutshell, Anderson enchants us. Fiennes freaking funny. Production perfect. grand, just great. I struggled to come up with a good nutshell for this one, so I went with alliteration, and I think all those facts are true. But here's some more facts. The critics like this film. 92% of them on Rotten Tomatoes say, yeah, 8.5 out of 10, according to Wikipedia. And 86% of audiences is also 187th on the IMDb 250, and I looked earlier today. We recorded this really early in April, so this could change. It could be one or two spots different by the time people might check this out later and think I'm wrong. Well, we're recording it early because the Oscar show we're going to record after this. We're out of order here. We're doing that as late as we possibly can so we can see Nomadland. Anyway, 187 on the IMDb 250 and 21st on the BBC Culture Top 100 list, which you sent me a few months ago. And going through it, one of the reasons why I thought we should maybe do this movie is because it's 21st.
And that list is specifically rating movies of the 21st century.
So far, yeah. That was a couple of years ago, I think it came out.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was 2017 or 2018. And number one was Mulholland Drive.
Like all lists, they have some very debatable choices, but we're going to cover a few of them this year. Mm-hmm. Seeing that made me think we should cover maybe In the Mood for Love, possibly, and A Separation, which we plan to do in just a few weeks from now. Grand Hotel, Grand Budapest Hotel. You said Grand Hotel earlier. Well, of course, this is almost the exact same title. Was 54th at the 2014 U.S. box office. American Sniper was number one, the Clint Eastwood movie, not a Marvel movie.
Yeah, that was such an anomaly.
Also up for Best Picture that year against Grand Budapest, and the winner, Birdman, which was 78th, and we covered that a couple years ago, and Whiplash, my favorite movie of both that year and of the decade, and one of my favorite movies, period. That was 125th. Pretty good year for films overall. So I said this won four Oscars. It was for the sets, the costumes, the makeup, and the music, and it was nominated for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Original Screenplay. All three of those, Wes Anderson was at least part of a nomination. He shared the nomination for producing and for writing. And it was up for editing and cinematography and could have won maybe every single one of those. But certainly the editing and cinematography Oscars could have gone to this movie as well. I watched the Oscar speeches before we sat down here. They were fine. They were decent. Nothing outstanding in there. But it seemed to me when we watched that night, but a little less so this time, that Wes Anderson was thrilled for everybody.
Yeah.
I still think he was, but it almost seemed more like he was just nervous to be there. I think Wes Anderson's not somebody who's really an awards guy exactly. But he seemed to be happy for everyone. He didn't have that, they won. Because that happens sometimes. Directors seem like they feel, yeah, the makeup guy wins, but what about me? Even though they usually get mentioned. And they all praise Wes Anderson up and down, as they should have.
He works with a lot of the same people over and over, particularly, you know, his production designers. Mm-hmm. He must have been thrilled when they won. It's pretty exciting.
Alexandre Desplat won for the score. I said that a minute ago. He was due. You look at his resume, he got nominated a lot of times. He went on to win for The Shape of Water a few years later, so he's got two now and could have a lot more than that. And his speech was pretty nice. And the makeup team mentioned Dick Smith, which was nice, because I guess he died earlier that year. And Dick Smith, if you know anything about makeup, is one of the legends. There's maybe three or four people that you think of right away. Rick Baker, Dick Smith are two names for sure that come up. Dick Smith worked on Taxi Driver, The Exorcist, and so many other great films.
To me, this movie doesn't have a lot of standout makeup in it.
The Tilda Swinton makeup, for one thing, that took a long time to do, apparently.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's a good one.
And she's barely in the movie. I read that, and I forgot how little she's in the movie until we watched it. Man, it's supposed to be this whole big thing. It took her so long to get ready to get made up. It was probably one day of shooting then for her, maybe two.
She's in a fair amount of the movie, I guess.
Is she?
Yeah, I guess you're right. She's not in a ton. Her corpse is in more. He wanted to cast Angela Lansbury, but there was scheduling conflict. She had already committed to be in a play. So he wanted to cast somebody who's already that age. Then he just decided to go completely the other direction. I usually criticize movies for casting people that against type. There's plenty of actresses who are older that could have been in this part, but it's so charming and funny. Tilda Swinton is hysterical.
This is also what Tilda Swinton does. Looking different, looking strange, sometimes playing men. She does that more than probably anybody in the modern era anyway. And also at Desplat's Oscar for the score, Desplat was unusual because a comedy doesn't usually win that award. They had two separate categories for a while there. I don't know how many years it was before this, the late 90s, maybe mid-90s, into the somewhere in the early 2000s. So then, of course, a comedy or musical would win an Oscar that way, but they were two separate awards. So when it's been one award, it's almost always gone to a drama, or at least a non-comedy. But here is an example of a comedy, and a truly funny one at that. Okay, well, we both like this movie a lot. We try to see every Wes Anderson movie on the big screen when we can. He didn't release one last year that we had to miss, or so far this year. But if he does release one, I think he's got The French Dispatch coming sometime soon. It probably would have been out already. Yeah. But whenever that does come out, we'll probably see it in the theater. He's one of those people that we treat as a must-see type of filmmaker. I don't really know why, because he makes good movies, but it's not like a zeitgeisty film that everyone's talking about usually either.
We love him. And his movies are better on the big screen. There's so many details that you want to pay attention to. The big advantage of the big screen is that it really forces you to focus on the film and really get lost in it. And he creates these worlds. It's just worth it. It's worth it for most films, I suppose. Just about every movie is made better by a theater experience.
I don't agree with that entirely.
Well, I guess that's fair.
Reasons I've given before. The screen and the sound, usually yes. But the other factors, not so much. Okay, anyway, we watched it, I think, a week ago. It's not really fresh in our minds anymore. But what did you think this time of the Grand Budapest Hotel?
I think it's just marvelous. Wes Anderson at his Wes Andersoniest. He's just so witty and creative, and he's kind of like Gustav in that he's so meticulous and uncompromising, but it always feels like an act of love. My one criticism would be that I feel like this film kind of lacks that emotional, vulnerable hook that most of his other films have. I know it's a function of the theme that our narrator simply can't bear the power of his own emotions, but the film's a little distant from my taste.
Yeah, I agree. And it's also interesting they kill off Gustav off screen, much like my favorite Anderson movie, which is Royal Tenenbaums. They just mentioned that Hackman died. But you do see him in the ambulance, at least, with Ben Stiller. So there's a bit of a moment of almost death and a funeral. In this, we just hear he died. You never see, I don't think, a funeral. You see him marrying off Zero and Agatha. Mm-hmm. So it's the opposite of a funeral in that situation. But that was earlier in the last bit of the film. But anyway, the most important character is just gone. And that is a Wes Anderson touch, just like killing an animal. This time a cat. Yeah. It was a dog in Royal Tenenbaums. He does deal in tragic comedy, and that's what this certainly is. But maybe that's one reason why it doesn't work as effectively as something like Royal Tenenbaums does, because it doesn't have the emotional hook that that does. The other great line in that movie, one of the many great lines, but Ben Stiller towards the end, "I've had a really hard year, Dad." Mm. They finally connect, those two. These two don't need to connect because Zero and Gustav are always pretty tight, I would say.
I have a theory for what Grand Budapest Hotel is missing that Royal Tenenbaums has, and you just kind of said it in Ben Stiller. So in Royal Tenenbaums, most of the performances are those same very extremely deadpan performances. Luke and Owen Wilson and Gwyneth Paltrow, they all have these impenetrable performances. But Ben Stiller in that movie is so vulnerable and open. He's the one that really draws you in. He's the one that's had the most tragedy because his wife died and who kind of needs that connection the most. I say also Angelica Houston, she has such a gentleness and her character is so genuinely motherly that it helps you let your guard down. So I think in a way it's the performances that invite you to feel their vulnerability and get invested in their emotions. And there was no character like that in Grand Budapest Hotel.
Well, I think you should quit. Angelica Houston's great line in that movie.
I love her in that movie so much.
That's the only other Wes Anderson movie we've ever covered, Royal Tenenbaums, which was, I think, early 2017. And now four plus years later, we finally do another one of his movies. I guess we should do Fantastic Mr. Fox at some point, because that's the other one I love, the three I love the most of his movies.
It is another one, though, Fantastic Mr. Fox, where I don't think there's a vulnerable character. Isle of Dogs as well is the same. His two animated feature films, I think, suffer the same curse that Grand Budapest Hotel has. The Artifice just, I guess, crosses an edge that makes me feel like the film is a little more arm's length. Rushmore, Olivia Williams is that vulnerable character. Darjeeling Limited.
Owen Wilson's character, and in reality, I think it was before that, tried to commit suicide.
Yeah, that's right. There was a parallel there between reality and fiction.
So if Grand Budapest wasn't as funny as it actually is, maybe we wouldn't love it as much as we do. And of course, you've got a guy who so surprises it by being that hilarious. We've covered him at least one other time, Schindler's List, where he plays this incredible Nazi villain. And of course, he's now M in the Bond movies, Voldemort, everyone knows that probably. You look at his resume, he's done a lot of voiceover work in animation. I don't think he's ever worked with Anderson in his two animated films, but he's done a lot of voiceover work too. He's built up this incredible career, and yet when we saw this movie, I think one of the reasons why I put it on a pedestal that it was on, and probably still belongs there, maybe not quite as much, but it's because of his surprisingly hilarious performance. And things like, "Hands off my lobby boy!" The way he delivers that line, it's a pretty good line, but the way he delivers it is truly funny. And we've seen the movie at least three times now.
I always liked him, but this movie is what tipped me over the edge to absolutely loving him. And I don't think it was very long after this that A Bigger Splash came out. After that, I was so fully committed. I'm 100% Ralph Fiennes fangirl now.
He did comedy for the Coens in, what was that movie called, a couple years after this one? Hail Caesar.
Oh, God.
Plays the film director. Hasn't done a lot of comedies I'm aware of, though. Certainly nothing big. No big mentions. Usually it is dramas or very serious films. Of course, The English Patient, we talked about maybe doing that in this spot instead, because it is, 25 years old now this year?
Wow.
And that, of course, completely the opposite of this one, although set not that far apart time-wise, and both are effectively, certainly English Patient is, war films. That one doesn't deal with the war that much either, and this one skirts around it. This is set in the former Republic of, am I going to say this wrong, Zubrovka? The W is a V, right? That's how you pronounce it, Zubrovka, not Zubroika. Yeah, it must be Zubrovka.
Sure.
But when you call it the Grand Budapest Hotel, it makes it sound like it's in Hungary. But they don't actually literally call it Hungary. And then it must be World War II that's just starting to brew, because the Zero Gustav scenes are set in 1932. The Jude Law scenes, so he's the young writer, are in 68. And the book is written in 85. And Tom Wilkinson has played the older version. We barely see him. Very briefly, Tom Wilkinson is in the movie as the older Jude Law. Just like F. Murray Abraham. F. Murray Abraham is the older Zero, Mr. Mustafa, who's telling the story to the writer. Speaking of those characters right now, Law and Abraham, those actors, I'll do the what happens next, and it maybe fits Wes Anderson's tragicomic tone in this. Mr. Mustafa hangs himself because recounting the story has depressed him that much, but he would string up that colorful noose with charm and with humor. He would find a way to make it funny. And one of the reasons why is because he's just finished relating the story about how, I guess his friend, I think you would have to call Gustav his friend, died defending him long before. And it seems like a long time ago also, Agatha, his love, who he actually did marry, died of disease. And that seems like that was quite a long time ago. So this guy didn't have to be alone. He could have made other friends. He's a wealthy man, inherited all this wealth, but he's living alone all this time, seemingly. So I'm going the really dark route there, but it wouldn't surprise me if this guy just said, I just recounted this whole terrible story. I don't think I want to live anymore.
And he's pretty clear about the fact that the true tragedy to him isn't the loss of Gustav, even though Gustav clearly had this massive influence on him. And Gustav's story is the story that he wants to tell. But when the writer asks him, is that why you come back to the hotel in respect for him? He's like, no, I come back for Agatha because we were happy here.
Right. Well, when he proposes to her, if I have this right, it's marry me. Yes.
They're pretty cute.
She doesn't even hesitate. I'm sure Anderson directed them that way, which is the line is barely out of his mouth. And she's saying yes immediately. And she helps him out by getting Gustav and the other guys out of prison by hiding digging tools in the pastry she cooks. Of course, she's a baker. And that leads to one of the things he's always called twee. I don't think that has to be an insult that Wes Anderson's called twee, but one of the things that would definitely be considered twee in this case is when they are very slowly ding, 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 chipping away at stone and metal to get out of prison with these little Andy Dufresne's rock hammer going through, what is that, limestone or something like that? Aged rock. You can understand him eventually digging through that over 19 years. This probably would never actually work, but it does make for funny comedy scenes. Harvey Keitel has a small role in this film. Have you worked with Anderson before? I can't think of an example. There's so many actors. Let me just rattle them off here, the ones I've written down anyway. I'm sure I'm going to overlook somebody, but we know about Fiennes. Tony Revolori is Zero, and he is playing Flash now in the new Spider-Man films. Adrian Brody's a pretty big role as one of the villains. Defoe is his henchman. Jeff Goldblum is a pretty big role for a while in the movie. Edward Norton plays a cop. He's become an Anderson regular. We mentioned Keitel. Saoirse Ronan is Agatha. Matthew Amalric, I think I said the right, Amalric, whatever, from The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. Leah Seydoux, who's become fairly big. She's been a Bond girl. F. Murray Abraham, we mentioned already. Wilkinson and Law. And then all the concierges, the messieurs. Jason Schwartzman, Bill Murray, Bob Balaban, Fisher Stevens, Owen Wilson. I'm sure I've left some people out, but that cast, half of that cast would be impressive. But that's one of the Anderson techniques too, especially in the last maybe 10 years, putting together this extraordinary collection of actors, including a lot of longtime friends like Bill Murray, Jason Schwartzman, and I don't know if it's so much longtime, but Norton has been in quite a few of his movies. Brody's been in a few of his movies as well over the years. No Luke Wilson in this case, but Owen Wilson has got a very small role in this movie.
He's one of those directors where you don't really need anybody to tell you that he's great to work with because people just come back and work with him over and over again, kind of like the Coen brothers, where they have these loyal teams and these actors that will work with them whenever chance they get, anytime they get cast in one of their films.
One other thing you see with all those Oscar wins is that a lot of the cast was there. Fiennes wasn't, but Revolori was, Goldblum was, Brody was, and a few other ones were as well, were in the audience, and they were shown applauding whenever there was a win. But that is one great cast. Saoirse Ronan was still pretty new to Hollywood at this point. Well, she's been around for 7, 8, 9 years, something like that. But you don't think of her as, maybe not even now, as a true star. I don't think the average person knows who that is. They should, because we've covered her a few times before. Certainly the Oscar shows we've had to do, because she's been nominated so many times in her short career. And doesn't have a huge role here. But getting back to what you just said, in a way, she does. She is Zero's motivation, I guess, through a lot of the movie. And then why he's telling the story in the first place, why he goes back to that hotel in the first place. So maybe her role not literally on screen is all that huge, but to this character, obviously, it is.
Not just because she motivated Zero, but because, as he says, with tears in his eyes, she saved us. She was a hero. She was very brave. First, she hides the tools and the cakes for them, and then she's the one that goes into the hotel and actually gets the painting and is hanging from the side of the building. She's a hero.
And she sees the little envelope that's in the painting when she's hanging over the edge. No one else had ever seen that before.
Yeah.
Risks her life. They probably should have died when they fell, even though they did fall into the truck. Yeah, that's a little bit of a phony moment there, because they both should have been badly hurt or dead. But she's the one that sees the envelope, and then they realize in the end, oh, Gustav actually got this, because it's a whole thing. Madame D's son is Brody's character. I guess an Anderson-type villain, not somebody who's truly loathsome. Defoe, here's another one who's been in a lot of Anderson's movies. Life Aquatic, he's really funny in Life Aquatic.
Yeah, he's
steals that whole movie, I'd say. He is a bona fide villain in this movie, but more of a Bond villain in a way. I mentioned Bond people like Fiennes playing M and Sidhu playing a Bond girl at least once. Probably just once, I'm guessing. Spectre, maybe? I forget which one it was. But Defoe is basically Oddjob in this movie, and then has what is a funny death, but pushed to his death by Zero over a cliff.
Ew. As Gustav recites poetry.
A lot of hanging off of dangerous areas for people in this movie. They should be falling to their death. But our heroes never do. It's just Defoe in that instance does.
Yeah, he really puts his characters through the ringers. And it's funny how they go through some pretty cartoonish circumstances in this film. But there are real deaths. And
a lot of deaths in this movie.
Most tragic deaths when they happen. And those, of course, are Gustav and Agatha.
We don't see them.
They're banal. They're also really banal. It's the way that life grinds at you. It's one of Wes Anderson's recurring themes. He makes these really melancholic movies about tragedy and about grief, and they're always comedies, and they're always legitimately funny, but he really does focus a lot on death. His characters are always dealing with grief and loss, and he always kills the dog. In this movie, it's the cat, but he'll always kill an animal, a thing you should never do in a comedy. But he can cross that line because all of his movies are really about that. I feel like this film is him talking about himself in many ways. One of those is what I was saying earlier about how Gustav is kind of him. He is precise, and he cares about every single itty-bitty detail.
By the way, quick thing, looking up some stuff before we sat down, I saw a quote from him saying, I don't think I'm that obsessed with detail. Really? Every director who's ever made a movie should be, even the crap movies.
Who is he comparing himself
exactly.
to?
Exactly. Is there anybody more exacting in the modern era, at least, than him?
Well, maybe he's not that exact. Maybe he's more plays by the seat of his pants than we realize when he's in the moment. You see his classic tableaus, and we think it's really precise, but maybe he just actually is that good that he can be there in the moment, see a bunch of objects, and know exactly where to place them.
Maybe he's just a savant, then.
I think he is a savant. He's an incredibly talented filmmaker, at least one of the best filmmakers, I'd say, of his generation, at least as auteurs go, and he may not be everybody's taste. I'm going to jump to talking about how I think Wes Anderson is talking a little bit about himself in this film. One, in the way that he's dealing with the themes that he deals with in every single film, but a lot of people don't like Wes Anderson movies, and that's totally fair. But I say the chief criticism that his work receives is that they're pretentious, too artsy, and I reject that criticism, and I want to defend him against that accusation. I think that Anderson sees his artistry as a gift that he gives his viewers, the same way that Gustav is very particular. Mm-hmm. Everything he does is overkill, kind of the same as Wes Anderson. But when Gustav does it, it's not to be snobby. It's not because he thinks he's better than everybody else and he's trying to prove something to everybody else. When Gustav does it, it's truly an act of love.
It's also his job.
Okay, but he doesn't have to be as extreme as he is. And you see the way he is at the beginning of the film, the way he's fawning over Madame D. The initial assumption I think everybody watches when they first see this film is that he's kissing her ass, all false flattery.
Like in The Producers.
The second she's
Zero
gone,
Mostel is making out with the older ladies.
Right, exactly. And then the second that she turns her back, he's going to make fun of her.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't, because he actually loves her. And when he is making sure the flowers are perfect and making sure every detail is just as it should be, it's because he wants her to be happy. That's his love language. Every chance he gets, he's telling Zero about how important civility is. This is how you express love. And I think that Wes Anderson has one of those creative energies that's kind of like Miyazaki, in that his creativity is so big and extreme and abundant
that he just gives the audience all these little gifts. There's so many details in this film in particular. I know it kind of sounds like I was dumping on it a little bit earlier, where I say, well, it keeps us at arm's length. It's a little bit cold by his standards. But I can't praise enough the artistry of this film.
And by the way, this is, if not the first time, one of his movies ever won or were nominated for Oscars for production design, makeup, costumes, all that stuff. And you think that most of his movies would have been almost every time. But finally, they get it all at once.
Yeah, this is the film that deserved it. I mean, a lot of his films deserved it.
Moonrise, I would say Tenenbaums.
Tenenbaums, oh my God. Tenenbaums is still, I think it's just always going to be my favorite Wes Anderson film.
And Life Aquatic is one of the best design movies of that year, 2004.
Yeah, and even Moonrise Kingdom, which is probably one of his weaker films, but the design in it is so outstanding and there's so many little details. I really feel like he's not trying to say, look how cool I am, like I curated all these beautiful things for you. I think he is a person that curates all these beautiful things because he loves them. That's how his films feel to me. The character of Gustav, in a way, is like Wes Anderson saying, see, I'm not making it up. I really love these things.
If someone's accusing him or ever did accuse him of being a phony, I think that's way off if that's what film critics were ever saying about him.
But it's fair if people, I think people think he's a snob. I think that his mood.
Snob and a phony are not the same thing in this case, though.
But I feel like a snob is kind of a phony, aren't they? If somebody's just making something to look like they're better than you, you feel lesser than, that's like active snobbery.
Didn't we say in Tenenbaums that he was a prep school kid, he was raised rich, so he might be a default snob person. Whether he actually is, I don't know. We know that Gene Hackman wasn't a fan of his on Tenenbaums, despite the fact it was such a good movie, and Gene Hackman himself was so awesome in it. Be a man or something. I don't know what Anderson did that Hackman would react that way, but it sounds like Gene Hackman was more of a dick than we ever really heard until more recent years. I could see him being a snob when he's raised rich and all the rest of it, and he's had such a great career from the beginning. He does Bottle Rocket, which wasn't some huge hit, but then Rushmore was beloved, and ever since then, he's gotten, probably relatively speaking, because he doesn't get gigantic budgets, but relatively speaking, whatever he's wanted ever since. But I don't think, in his case at least, that snobbery and being phony are the same thing. I think he believes in all this stuff. One more reason why I feel that way is because I'm a very precise person in my own way. I don't make movies, but I'm pretty precise about how I do things, the way things are upstairs in the kitchen. The way I do the podcast when I edit and all that kind of stuff. I do things the same way.
I can vouch for this. Let me second this.
So it's not like Anderson does. It's not as beautiful as that, what I do. But I'm pretty particular about how I live my life, too. I just feel more comfortable doing that. So I'm not sure Anderson does that, too, in his films or in his life. But I can see him maybe being that way. Mm-hmm. And if he is, then I can obviously relate to it.
If that's his personality, or like a tick of his personality, then it influences the way he expresses this gigantic well of creativity, and we are all so lucky to see his work and to just enjoy the things that come out of his brain. Come on, Grand Budapest Hotel, even though it's so much like his other films, it is still, even saying that, one of the most unique pieces of work put on celluloid, especially for a film with this budget. I guess it's not technically a big Hollywood film, but it had a pretty big budget by art film standards.
Yep.
So for this work to exist, for us to enjoy, it feels like a small miracle.
He's not the same. They're not that similar, actually. But he and Kubrick remind me of a lot of each other because of that. Because Kubrick is very specific with his style as well, or was. He's long dead now. But also the symmetrical framing and the very specific framing that they both had. I guess most directors probably do. But then some do have more of a slapdash quality. It's pretty hard to call Paul Greengrass's style
the exact same example.
Specific, yeah. Because he has so much of the shaky cam in most of his movies, and I don't watch that many action movies anymore, but I'm guessing that most of them couldn't be called specific because they're just trying to catch the action.
Yeah, nobody's ever going to accuse a Wes Anderson movie of being spontaneous. He must be influenced by Kubrick because there's elements of The Shining in this film.
It's a hotel movie.
It's a hotel movie.
A lot of killing. There's more killing in this comedy than there is in that horror film.
So if you look at the hotel on the mountain, it resembles the Overlook. You can't deny that. It is a big resort hotel on a mountain. But if you were ever wondering if they were trying to, not channel, but if there was any homages to The Shining, when you see the office of the older writer, not where he's sitting at his desk, but when he's sitting beside his desk with his grandson, the wallpaper behind him is precisely the carpet pattern from The Shining.
Oh, okay. Would you want that Boy with Apple painting?
I love the Boy with Apple painting. Right. I get the appeal of it. It is very
I'm not saying I don't want it. Just wanted to know if you wanted it.
Is it a real painting?
I don't know. I didn't look that up.
We should have looked that up. It looks like a real painting. It just looks like a masterwork. It's so cheeky.
the expression on his face, there's something about it that is so cheeky.
Really funny moment, too, when they take the painting off the wall. And it belongs to Gustav, so he has a right to take it. And they replace it with something that doesn't match up. Faded paint doesn't match at all. And Brody doesn't notice that until, what, an hour later in the movie? Hey!
I think it's days later, because on the sisters...
Well, I'm talking about it's an hour and 40 minutes, this movie. Oh, and it's maybe really? An hour later in screen time, so he actually notices that.
This is where Wes Anderson is so funny. The painting that he replaces, Boy with Apple... which is almost like a drawing of two lesbians. It's incredibly vulgar. Spread eagle, fingers in vagina. Basically pornographic.
Good for them.
Good for them. But the difference in tone and just the way that this film ever so often really does dip into vulgarity. I mean, particularly Gustav himself, who will be so perfect and precise and then every so often say something that is gutter vulgar.
We haven't sworn in this episode. Maybe we won't bother at all now, but... this movie has a lot more swearing in it than I remember it from the other times I've watched it, including from Ralph Fiennes, who is such a particular guy, but he says the F word several times.
Yeah, he only really lets his guard down when it's just him and Zero alone. He says things like, oh, she's shaking like a shitting dog. You would never say that in front of the guests. The quote that actually started the spark plug copy with extolling the virtues of civility. The way that quote really ends, it's said twice in the movie, but when he says it the first time, the way that quote really ends is him just trailing off and then going, oh, fuck it. Like, he can't even muster himself to extol the virtues of civility, which is his favorite thing.
Guess we have an R rating on this podcast now. As for Zero, Tony Revolori does a pretty good job. Deadpan the whole way as well. We do hear in voiceover from the older version that his lobby boy hours are brutal. He only gets a half day off every week. And even when he's working, it's not like he has an 8-hour day. I forget the exact hours.
It's five in the morning till midnight.
He started at 5 and then had to get up at 5.
Okay, fine, still.
Even if it was 7 to 11, if he was working a double shift every day, that's every day except for having a half day off on Sunday. Ew. Seems like it's a cool job, but that's a long time to work.
When did you have time to fall in love with Agatha?
When did he ever see her? Well, the Secret Society of the Cross Keys, that's the other concierges, they all help each other out. It's a big brotherhood. That's the very small role in this movie for Bill Murray. I wonder if he probably expected to have played Gustav. We talked on Royal Tenenbaums about how he thought he would end up playing Royal, but instead he played what ended up being a pretty major character in the non-family. Well, he's in the family because he's related. He's married to Gwyneth Paltrow. But in this movie, he's barely in it. He's been in every single Wes Anderson movie, including doing voices in the animated films. Since Bottle Rocket, because he didn't know him at that point. And he's also mentioned by one of the people that won an Oscar about how maybe the makeup person, whoever it was, though, that person was introduced to Wes Anderson by Bill Murray. But that was a cute touch, and they all look so different from different hotels, of course. Balaban, Fisher Stevens, Owen Wilson. And there's other guys, too. I didn't write all the names down. But they're guys, I think it's Wolodarski and Ola Wally or something like that. Wally Wolodarski is a Simpsons writer. I always knew the name Wallace, but Wally they call him. And then the South Asian guy. He's also one of the many people in the Society of the Cross Keys. Fun sequence, probably didn't need to be in the film exactly. But then, of course, the big shootout also happens. Apparently, George Clooney is one of the people involved in that shootout, and we thought we spotted him, so we paused it, we frame-by-framed it, and at a glance, sure, it looks like Clooney, but when you frame-by-frame it, no, it's not. So I'm not sure who Clooney is in that sequence, if he is in that sequence.
Maybe it's just a rumor, because they cast an actor happened to look a lot like George Clooney, and he's only on screen for less than a second, so all these people were like, George Clooney, but... maybe that's it, and he's not actually in it.
That could be, because, of course, he's a voice, the star of Fantastic Mr. Fox. So, obviously, Fiennes and Revolori, but Fiennes is the best thing in this movie. I like Saoirse Ronan a lot, seeing it this time. Edward Norton, he's a little bit too much in Wes Anderson films, but I do enjoy that he's in them. He's been in, I think, 3 of them, at least, maybe more. Of course, we've covered him in Fight Club and also Birdman that same year, so he went up on the stage with everyone else when they won Best Picture, but had this one Best Picture, he would have gone up the stage for that one. He was there for 2 movies, and he has not been a big player in Hollywood for many years because apparently he's not very popular.
It's a shame that he is a miserable jerk or whatever it is that makes him unpopular to work with, because I have always loved him as an actor.
His best work was in his early years, and I think his biggest problem is he likes to, well, he insists on tweaking screenplays. Can't leave well enough alone. The main reason he's not playing the Hulk now instead of Mark Ruffalo, although I think Ruffalo is better casting anyway. If you just had them both mentioned at that point and said, who do you think's better, Ryan? I would have said probably Mark Ruffalo, especially compared to Bill Bixby playing David Banner in the TV series. But Norton is not playing the Hulk and making all that money now because of the way he is. But he does a pretty good job in these films, and it's one of the more high-profile things he ever does anymore, it seems. Jeff Goldblum has done quite a few films, including The Life Aquatic for Anderson. I wasn't sure we'd ever covered him. I knew we had done Jurassic Park, And of course, he's also in Nashville. I forgot all about that. And he's got a small role in Annie Hall. But here's at least his third movie, or fourth movie, I should say, we've done of his. And we're probably going to do Independence Day this year because it's 25 years old. And The Fly, which is 35 years old.
We'll definitely cover The Fly someday.
So Wes Anderson, we've talked about his credits, I think, pretty much everything he's ever done at this point. I think we've mentioned them all. He's always sticking to his own style. The colors, his ensemble of actors, the twee, the quirkiness. I think it's more quirky than twee. He co-wrote with Hugo Guinness, who got a story credit. He's only done a few movies in his career. And they're based on Stefan Zweig's, quote-unquote, writings. Nearly 40 movies have been adapted from Zweig or Zweig's writings, novels, and stories over the years. There were many producers on this. Anderson himself, Scott Rudin, super producer, has done so many big things, including the Oscar for No Country for Old Men. Stephen Rales and Jeremy Dawson, both Wes Anderson regulars. And Rales also is an executive producer on Young Adult, which is our movie, next week. They work with Wes Anderson all the time. The aspect ratio is varying for this movie. It depends on the era. Sometimes it's in 4:3, other times it's true widescreen, and other times beyond that, it's not quite as wide a widescreen. I didn't really notice that. I never really dwell on that the way some people do. I'm not noticing the screen changing, even though it's a technique and a touch on purpose.
I never notice it.
I'm looking at the non-black part of the screen.
I know people talk about how it drives them crazy sometimes when a film mixes IMAX with 35mm or something. In this case, it makes total sense. I actually think it's a great technique, especially when you have to differentiate time periods like that. The colors change from decade to decade significantly, but I would say the way that they shot it, it's not like they did different washes of film or anything to give it a different look. So the aspect ratio is a great technique to do that. And of course, it's appropriate in the sense that they were time accurate for what was the most popular at that time.
His cinematographer, Robert Yeoman, another Wes Anderson regular, also worked on Dogma and Bridesmaids. So at least four of his movies are in our archives because Royal Tenenbaums would be the fourth one. The editor, Barney Pilling, the only thing he ever did with Wes Anderson. It was nominated for an Oscar, as was Yeoman. He also did An Education and Annihilation. Say that five times fast. And we mentioned Desplat, the composer. 11 Oscar nominations and 2 wins for this and for The Shape of Water.
It's funny you mention Annihilation, because a few years ago when Annihilation first came out, I had the opportunity to go see a screening with the director, Alex Garland, and he gave a wonderful interview afterwards. One of the things that always stuck with me is he was very keen to give credit to his collaborators, and he would call them collaborators. You notice this outfit, you notice these details. I didn't come up with those. That was my set dresser, that was our costume person, that was the cinematographer, that was the actor. And he was like, people give directors way too much credit. Yes, we're the boss, we're the people making the decision, but we are collaborators. So when we talk about this crew that works with Anderson over and over again, you know that whoever is his prop person probably can like read his mind to some extent, but also is an incredibly talented person who certainly brings their vision to the film as well, and their talent, their creativity. A film like this cannot possibly get made without a team. I mean, just look at those beautiful tableaus with the painted backgrounds and the animatronics. The artistry there. It's not like Wes Anderson was there with a paintbrush making these things happen. Obviously, part of being a great director is curating this talent and directing it. The script is so beautiful. The story itself is really elegant and intricate, incredibly complex, both in plot and even just the structure of it is so strange. It's experimental, really. It's like a story within a story within a story within a story. Mm-hmm. And one of the very main themes of the film, along with civility, along with grief, is the way that stories change with storytelling. Storytelling can create distance. When we meet Zero in the hotel and he's old and we understand that he's lonely and sad, he's also very keen on telling his story, keen to immortalize Gustav as like a gift for everything he did. Life is cruel. Life destroys, but art preserves. Mm-hmm. But art also creates distance, and I'm complaining about how the film is distant, but I also do feel like that's the point. There's so much artifice because all story is artifice.
That's also been a thing that people, even if they've liked him, have said about Kubrick over the years. Sometimes he did, but he doesn't always draw you, or didn't always draw you in.
Look at 2001, one of his most famous and beloved films. A film of his that I don't particularly like. I respect it a lot, but I never choose to watch it. I find it incredibly cold, and if I'm being terribly honest, boring.
But here's a screenplay where the language is so beautiful. The way that Gustav speaks, what actor wouldn't love to sink their teeth into that dialogue? Everything he says is extraordinary.
One of the better roles, I would say, is Norton. He's got some good lines to give to. They all do, but Norton's got some great lines. Goldblum's in the movie more than I remembered. And also, we talked about the cat being killed. His cat is the one that's killed because he's the executor of Madame D's will. But he loses his fingers before he loses his life.
I know.
And it's
so
not
brutal.
Real looking. It looks fake because it's supposed to, because they probably don't want to turn us off completely. But he is losing four fingers getting chopped off in a door by Defoe's character. Pretty gruesome thing, even if it doesn't look as bad as it might if it had been a Saw movie or something.
It's like applying a cartoonish style to horrifying events. Jeff Goldblum's character is very lovable. He was meant to represent the vulnerable populations in World War II, like Jews and gypsies.
Truly just doing his job, too.
And he's quite professional, actually. Mm-hmm. Like Gustav, he values his profession very highly, and he does his job well, and he wants to do it right, very much according to the law.
And Adrian Brody's character has plenty. He doesn't need a painting, too.
It's bizarre that
or
they
that hotel.
If they had just let him keep the painting.
Mm.
Although I guess still the butler would have found the other will, yada yada.
Right.
But as a MacGuffin, it's a bizarre thing. The painting isn't worth that much compared to everything else in this estate.
Yeah.
I think it's wonderful how they write this incredibly complex story that also calls attention to the way storytelling is a tool and a gift.
Well, I'm not going to say this is true, but it's also always a possibility when you've got a movie that's supposed to be somebody relating what happened, and then a book is written about it. I don't think he is, but Zero could be telling lies.
Well, he leaves out some really important details. He wants to lionize Gustav.
Mm-hmm.
There's perfect reason to believe that he's maybe polishing the story here and there.
Mm-hmm.
And even though Agatha was the love of his life and the great tragedy of his life, he doesn't really talk much about her at all. She's definitely in the story, but she doesn't get the big part that Gustav gets, and her death especially is a couple of sentences.
If you were sneezing during the screening, you may not even notice he said anything like that.
Yeah, totally.
That's how quick it is.
Mm-hmm.
And much like the character in Ready Player One, Olivia Cook, I think is her name, has a birthmark on her face that makes her so hideous.
So hideous!
All right, then our last movie of Oscar month, probably the most enjoyable of the four. Well, The Man for All Seasons was pretty dull. And Departed is a great film, but we've talked about how we had some issues.
This is clearly our favorite.
Well, Departed we had some issues with for sure, partly because, as I said in that podcast, Scorsese wins his Oscar for that, really. But this movie had Anderson going up on stage and won that night. I wouldn't have argued at the time. I had it 8th that year on my best of list, looking at that earlier today. I thought maybe it was higher than that. Birdman I had higher than that. Boyhood I had higher than that. They both were nominated against this.
Would you pick this over Birdman now, all these years later?
It'd be closer. Over Boyhood, yeah. But over Birdman, that would be tough. They'd be very close, let's put it that way.
Birdman is a much more flawed movie than this. But man, I love it. I'm a Birdman apologist. I know of quite a few people personally who hate that movie. I'm not mad that it won Best Picture, even over this film.
Both of them have pretty big casts. And I think one of the reasons why movies like either of these do end up winning Best Picture, Crash is a great example of this too, is when you have a big cast, that's the biggest voting body for the Oscars. These people who are in your movie are people that could vote for Best Picture. But also it is a matter of, well, that's a great actor's movie. And so is that a great actor's movie from whatever that year was, and so on and so on. Shakespeare in Love is a good example of this. That's definitely an actor's movie. Saving Private Ryan is to some degree, but that's more of an action movie and a war movie, obviously.
All actors love Shakespeare, right?
Also true. So that's maybe one reason why that won. Why Crash maybe won with its big cast over the small cast of Brokeback Mountain. And why this was probably second. It's hard to say if it was second behind Birdman that night. Whiplash was up for the Oscar. I would have obviously voted for that if I could have.
Oh, yeah.
American Sniper was the biggest hit of that year. Not the best movie, not even close to it. But it probably got a lot of votes, too. Clint Eastwood film, always will. But yeah, pretty solid year at the movies. We've covered a lot of the 2014 films. We did that a couple years ago when they were 5 years old. And now here this one in Oscar month, because why not? It deserved it. And it deserved it more than English Patient, Beautiful Mind, Cimarron, Around the World in 80 Days, and The Artist was one I thought about covering, because we could rip it to shreds.
Man, yeah, that would be a mean podcast.
So your last thoughts on the Grand Budapest Hotel?
It's marvelous.
And I just gave my last thoughts that I think I'd re-rank it if I could for 2014. This is a terrific tragicomedy. So that is it for Oscar month. In 7 days, we'll keep talking about comedies as we analyze the self-absorbed author from The Mini-Apple. Charlize Theron does perhaps her very best work in young adult. Oscar for a monster. I've always said it, one of the great performances I've ever seen. So this isn't better than that, but it might be more interesting and deeper work in some ways than a great performance, one of the best ever in Monster. But in both cases, she's a bit of a sociopath. Okay, so the coming attractions trivia question. There's a nice little softball coming. What was the last movie we covered that had a delusional blonde and a cute little Pomeranian?
All right, so for the answer to that question, please check out next week's podcast about young adult. In the meantime, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to us wherever you listen. All our episodes are available for free. That includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 98 and or 07 lists of the best American films ever made, and hundreds more titles. In exchange for all this great content, give us a rating and a review. That helps people find us. If you want to reach us, we're both on Twitter. I'm at BevEllisEllis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code TOP100PROJECT, and that's one word, TOP100PROJECT, it's not case sensitive, for a 20% discount.
With respect to this terrific movie, I have to steal a line from the other Wes Anderson movie we've covered, because it's such a great line from Gene Hackman, but let's shag ass.
Oh, now we have to watch that movie.
And also, I'm sorry your mother died. She was a very attractive woman. This is also the Royal Tenenbaums podcast.